This episode of AVXL is brought to you by our awesome crew of Patreon supporters. Check out our page at patreon.com/AVXL. AVXL episode 33, recorded on December 28th, 2016. We're going to talk CES 2017 UHD Blu-rays. Oppo's sweet new Blu-ray player is in the wild. And hey, you can get 4K Blu-rays playing on a PCBD drive. Now, seriously. Well, almost. In any case, subwoofers versus hard drives, child-proofing your home theater cables, and our beloved handbrake encoder has hit 1.0 after 13 years. Seriously, people, the end of the world is nigh. All that and so much more on this episode of AVXL.
Testing 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content, no matter what your budget is. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
And we're a little beyond home theater. We're mostly home theater.
We are beyond.
We love music. We love headphones. We love speakers. We love stereo playback. I think we
gaming.
Both... Gaming.
Stimulating the senses.
The occasional foray into VR, although quite frankly, it's a little early yet.
I even like to whip out the binoculars and look around once in a while.
Hey.
Outdoors, even.
Easy with that whipping stuff out, buddy. I like going on walks outdoors. I
like fresh air.
Fresh air, sunshine, and the love of a good dog.
And coffee. Oh, dogs are great.
Dogs are great.
I've been buying a lot of dog-related or pet-related gifts, too, to make sure they're not overlooked at this holiday gift-giving season.
My oldest son loves buying toys for the pets.
Yeah.
But none of the pets actually play with the toys.
Aw.
And, you know.
So he's buying those for himself.
Well, he just likes buying things. But, you know, he has discovered we have a new cat. And
have you got the kids eating pet food yet?
No.
Oh, really? They must have already.
Well, if they've done it, they've done it secretly.
Anything the animals ate, I always sampled as a kid.
Well, there was a running joke at one point where we picked up some dog biscuits for the dog, and the dog hated them. But our oldest boy, who was 3 at the time, was like, it's a cookie. And I'm like, it's not a cookie. And he's like, it's a cookie, and grabs it. And, you know, it was like lovingly handcrafted by organic tree huggers in the wilds of Northern California.
It sounds like entertainment about to happen.
Well, yeah, his face was.
That first bite.
Yeah, so disappointing. What is that? It's carrots, son. Why are there carrots in the cookies? It's not a cookie. It's a dog biscuit. Hands it back to me.
Lesson learned.
Oh, my goodness. Technically, this is a podcast about, you know, home theaters, television screens, 4K, Blu-ray.
I'm still coming down from the food fest of the holidays around here, man. It's just people cooking like crazy.
I think I ate and folded laundry for like 4 days.
I saw a lot of that going on.
Folding laundry or eating?
I saw a lot of eating. The roommate got a new smoker.
Oh, man.
So that was the, man, that thing saw some action the last few days. So. Good. I had
Nothing
an interesting to do with my TV, just briefly.
Netflix nearly killed your television, I think is what happened.
No, it wasn't so much Netflix. I was watching that, and then I will say not all content on Netflix is created equally, clearly. And there are some older shows that really, I can't believe there isn't a better source for the material to be encoded from. However,
I will be honest with you, I have been amazed at how crappy the telecine is on a lot of older television shows that aren't particularly popular, but more importantly, a lot of children's programming, horrendous transfers.
I think a lot of it has to do with these were interlaced video sources, and I see as it's delivered through streaming in progressive formats.
Right.
In particular, I was watching Deep Space Nine, an old school Star Trek spinoff. Anytime there's a dark scene, you get all the compression artifacts in the world, as bad as anything I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And then beyond that, constantly, I mean, granted, some of the CG effects back in the day, I believe those were even done at a lower resolution just because of the technology of the time. Yeah. However, whenever they go to those scenes, the jagged artifacts and other things like that are really evident. And this encourages me to at least go look at a DVD version that was probably, hopefully, still available somewhere, just to see if at least that source material looks a little bit better. Mm-hmm. Because It wouldn't, given the power of Netflix and their ability to recode video on the fly, if anybody can find a better copy of that and clean that up a little bit, I would hope it'd be them. And yeah. I just wonder, maybe this is one of the videos that hasn't even been touched yet by their new re-encode system. I kind of doubt it, but you never know.
Well, it's also a situation where the re-encode system isn't going to help if it's a bad capture in the first place. Like, garbage in, garbage out.
Very true.
And, you know, I'm trying to remember what cartoon it was, but I remember thinking, like, man, couldn't somebody have just
paid a little more attention to this? Is this the best source they had? You know, did they grab all the VHS tape off the shelf?
Exactly. It's just like you see the treatment some classics get, and then there's so much other content out there that probably isn't going to receive that level of attention in terms of bringing it back. Other fun thing, just technical foobah happened in the house. I was to be reasonable to the house, I decided to turn on closed captioning on my relatively late model Samsung television. And so I had that rolling so I could at least read what was happening without turning up the volume. And when I turned that system back off in the menu system, it left a word up on the screen that never went away.
Oh, no.
And because it was written in a spot on the screen and it didn't get overwritten, or the rewrite call never happened, no matter what I did, turn the TV on, turn the TV off, change inputs, go through every menu option to reset the TV within the regular menus, nothing. This word in its glorious, you know,
just sat there.
50-point font is up on the screen. And
taunting
I'm like,
you.
Yeah. And finally, I was just like, so I tweeted out a minor complaint. And if it ever comes down to something like that, or an app is stuck, or some part of the software is funky in a TV, the easiest thing to do is simply unplug it from the wall outlet for at least 5 minutes to completely let it drain its built-up capacitance power, basically. Most of these TVs will have an LED on the front indicating, and even after you unplug it, it will still remain lit until that power is drained out. So as soon as you see that light go off on the front, usually it's completely drained by then. That generally, at least on Samsung TVs, will reset the TV to a point where it's going to reboot all the software from a clean state, and including, thankfully, that closed captioning text that I couldn't get to go away. I almost took a trip into the service menu to fully gut reset the TV, but I'm glad I didn't have to, because that would have then required me to re-enter things like my white balance setup and other calibration things I had done. So
it's just a world-class pain in the
minor little software glitch, but on a relatively new TV too. And you know, just trying to figure a simple way to fix it, and generally, be it an app misbehaving or whatever, just unplug that TV for 5 minutes and plug it back in. Simple.
It's like rebooting your router, but less emotionally traumatic.
Yes. Oh, routers. Build your own. That's the problem.
Rest in peace, General Organa. After a heart attack suffered on a flight, I want to say from London to LAX, after completing all of her shooting in the next Star Wars episode.
Carrie Fisher.
Carrie Fisher's
rest passed. In peace.
Yeah, no, sorry. It's been amazing to watch the outpouring online, right? Because somebody passes.
Totally.
You know? I mean, it's been a rough year for music. Bowie, Prince, so many other deaths. It was interesting because a friend of mine, for him, Star Wars was a huge part of how extraordinary Carrie Fisher was, even though that had been such a small portion of her career. Obviously, just this huge thing that looms over culture for people of a certain age.
Anybody involved in that movie.
Absolutely.
It's hard to be, or it's hard to not escape that branding.
Yeah, no doubt.
But the Empire.
You know, for him, it was her discussing her fights with bipolar disorder, you know, and it had just been such an extraordinary thing that made it possible for him to start talking about it, right? And, of course, addiction and lots of other forms of mayhem that happened with when you're a young person in Hollywood in the 70s and 80s. But
that's cool. I really respected her for the ability to later in life look back at it, reflect on it, and tell us a little bit about it. And you know, I'm sure a lot of it was to help herself as much as anything. But at the same point, she's also just been in a few other movies too, and even great cameos and things that I always remember.
Well, her role in the Blues Brothers.
It's for a few minutes, but oh,
they're great minutes.
Fires a light armor weapon at Belushi.
Like you've never wanted to fire an anti-tank weapon in your necks. There's a great...
And among many others. And, of course, Princess Leia.
Yeah.
Good golly.
Oh, my goodness.
And later, General Organa.
Yeah. Postcards from the Edge, fantastic book. Her one-woman show, Wishful Drinking, is available. If you have HBO Now, it's really fun to watch. Talented human being, and we will miss her. And it was great to see her do General Organa before she passed.
Reminding self, I really need to see these new movies.
I'll loan you the Blu-ray for...
I haven't seen any of them.
I don't know. I can't wait. I still haven't seen...
I'm a binge watcher at heart, so I try to wait for a few...
A few.
Editions.
If I can't watch 8 hours of a given series, I'm not watching it at all.
if I have a free day.
Oh, man. You had a great show to a picture of Carrie Fisher from the Blues Brothers on One Perfect Shot.
Oh,
you've never seen it.
Their Twitter feed's great.
It's amazing.
If you look at actually their Twitter profile page right now, they have a picture of her as Princess Leia on the background, and it looks really sharp. It's a nice tribute they put up there. But they have been peppering their Twitter feed with lots of good Carrie Fisher related tweets and scenes and tidbits and stuff.
It also turns out it's the 82nd. One thing I found out from One Perfect Shot today is it's the 82nd birthday of Maggie Smith, who you may know as the Dowager Countess
I don't know. These words you're saying, I'm unfamiliar with everything.
Downton Abbey?
No.
You haven't seen Downton Abbey
not
yet?
I'm not ignoring Downton Abbey. I don't want to. Oh, I'm not even going to go there. Too many people love that. And I have no exposure to it at all. So I don't even want to open my mouth.
Maggie Smith, you might also know her from...
was she awesome?
From
the
Harry Potter movies. Oh, yeah.
There's another bunch of movies I've never seen or read the books.
She...
I'm out of current culture.
Oh, man. Professor McGonagall. She plays Professor McGonagall in the Harry Potter series. She's just a fantastic actress to watch.
I am nodding in agreement.
So happy 82nd birthday.
Any of her body of work.
I can't believe you haven't seen Downton Abbey yet.
It'll hit me.
One day.
I will binge that.
Well, you can watch there's like 4 or 5 seasons out on Netflix now.
Okay.
13 years in the making. A tool I use every week on Tech Thing and lots of other places. Handbrake has hit 1.0.
About time.
So this is like a tool. If you've encoded video, there's a really staggeringly high chance that you used Handbrake for it. VP9 encoding, UHD color pass through, quick sync, Intel CPU acceleration has been added.
That was good. That was a couple weeks ago. I talked about one of the features of looking in the beta versions of Handbrake, and that was one of the things that was added specifically, the quick sync Intel CPU acceleration. And while I don't see within the Handbrake app any direct support for GPU acceleration.
Right.
One of the things I keep coming across with GPU accelerated video encoding is that you're often limited in terms of the preset configurations for GPU encoding.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, you can do very fast work on a GPU, but you can't get the quality results you can get with the customizations of CPU encoding. And so if you happen to have an Intel CPU from last year, this year, and beyond, chances are it's going to support the quick sync technology built into that chip that can accelerate the encoding process for Handbrake 1.0. And that's great. You don't even have to look for a beta version anymore. You just grab the regular version sitting right on the top of the website. But the VP9 encoding, we were talking about that in relationship to Netflix's distribution of their new mobile content that you can download and save on your phone. And that UHD color pass-through, specifically if you're encoding into DCI or BT2020 for some reason, you can at least pass that color information along to the display or the encoder or the decoder. Excuse me. Jeez.
Yeah.
But sweet.
The nice people at Handbrake want to remind you that there is only one legitimate source of Handbrake in the known and unknown universes. That's handbrake.fr. That's their home website.
Seriously. I know so many people that they know the app they want, and then they'll find it in the most ridiculous places where it's been altered EXEs and
Bob's House malware and death. Download here, please.
Go to the source.
Oh, my goodness.
Please.
Yeah. It's available on Windows, Mac, and Linux. It's free and open source. And much like VLC, it's one of those tools that is a Swiss Army knife for dealing with video.
Apparently, they've dumped the old profile system, too, of the different encoding profiles you can preload. And now it's a new system with apparently a better way of doing it. So just be realized if you had a bunch of customized
presets
ready to go, you'll probably have to do some conversion in order to get those working within the new Handbrake. But it sounds like a design change for the better in the long term. So digging it. Dig my Handbrake. How many free video encoders are out there, let alone ones that are even worth using? So
that's an interesting conversation we'll save for another show. Ugh. We could go way down that one. You got a tweet. KenpoB10 tweeted, using Oppo UDP 203 HDMI in with Roku 4 for streaming app support. Kludgy, but effective.
I am glad to see that player out in the wild. We were talking about color output on these players and how we had some issues a week or two ago about how some players, when they're decoding the video off of a UHD Blu-ray, aren't providing mathematically exactly the right information, or at least representing it off the disc perfectly. Most of the time, these differences or these errors aren't noticeable, but just knowing that they're there, or you could put up a test pattern that could identify it, it's a matter of just simply doing things right. And it seems like the delay on the UDP 203 from Oppo was specifically to address a color decoding issue for the new ultra-high-def discs. And if it's out in the wild now, I'm assuming they've got that fixed. So that was a pretty good turnaround in terms of identifying that problem and then getting it out there. And even if it shipped bugged, you know they were on that at least. And they've said if you had a pre-production one, I guess. I don't even know. I don't know if they would have shipped it. Their initial reports were that they weren't even going to ship the player until that bug was fixed. So I'm assuming that it has been. Because folks like KenpoB10... has that awesome player in hand. And everyone was like, oh, there's no apps built into it. And is that a potential issue?
I don't have
issue?
A real problem with that. In fact, I think that may be a benefit, not a bug.
Except for game consoles that generally have overpowered in terms of their horsepower for apps and stuff. Your set-top boxes, like your Blu-ray players and things, those age rather quickly in terms of their usability and how much you really want to use that particular app that has probably not been updated as often as the thing on your mobile device or let alone a TV, a late model TV. So, yeah, I kind of like having that integrated HDMI input on the Oppo player so you can just add whatever the hell you want as far as your streaming goes. And, it's a little kludgy. Kludgy? Kludgy, but effective.
Kludgy.
To quote a KenpoB10. It's kind of nice, though. I want that player badly. Just to have it as a reference player, I might have to break down and add it to the lab hardware.
Oh man, we're talking about Adapt Sound, the feature that's buried inside the Samsung phones.
Oh yeah,
you're pretty into that.
It was just something neat, man. And last week, after mentioning that, I was just surfing the web, and I forget exactly how I came across this, but on the IEEE website, the International Electrical Engineers. I don't know what IEEE suddenly stands for, but that's okay.
I'll look it up when you're talking about the article.
Basically, there's a great article on there about using deep learning to improve the performance of hearing aids. And there is a group of researchers at Ohio State University that have been working on this for a while. And the gist of this article that I will, of course, link to in our show notes was that by exposing these deep neural network classifier tools to the desired sound that they wanted to hear, they could then have it learn to filter out various types of noise in a learning type recurred or reiterative setup. So, in a sense, for a long time now, and if you talk to anyone who uses a hearing aid, making sound louder isn't helpful.
Right.
And one of the biggest challenges they run into is a scenario where you're trying to hear a single voice in a crowded or noisy environment. This has been described as, quote, the cocktail party problem, apparently first described in the early 50s. This has been a known issue.
Which makes sense when you realize how many people had permanent hearing damage after World War II.
Yep. So by using this neural network and this classifier system where they say, here's the desired sound, and then we're gonna feed it various types of, we're going to introduce various known types of noise and have it automatically deal with it and learn to figure out its own best way to do that. And by doing that, they've seen some huge improvements in their subjects in the lab setup environment. Basically, over a 2x improvement in speech comprehension.
Whoa.
And in some cases, dramatically more. And this improvement could also be applied to, say, people who have regular hearing too, in terms of you're just in a noisy environment and you need to better perceive voices specifically or some sound that needs to be isolated from the noise in the background. And of course, this is an early bit of work, and they even have a claim where, yes, there's a lot more to be done. And to quote the article, they get into some of the limitations about their current setup, and they highlight it really well, and I'll just quote this. For example, in our samples, the type of noise that obscured speech was still quite similar to the type of noise the program had been trained to classify. To function in real life, a program will need to quickly learn to filter out many types of noise, including types different from the ones it had already encountered. For example, the hiss of a ventilation system is different from the hum of a refrigerator compressor. Also, the noisy samples we used did not feature reverberations from the walls or objects in a room, which compounds the noise problem at any cocktail party. And thank you, Patrick. The Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. There you go. IEEE. But that's a terrific terrific article I'll link to. Give it a look through. There's also, it links off to lots of previous research in this field. And it's just showing how some of these new learning systems or these new digital systems to be able to analyze large blocks of data and to create better adjustments than we're capable of doing manually are pretty neat, I gotta say. This is exactly the kind of work that we should be training machines to do. Because you could just imagine if you're trying to create a hearing aid and you're manually trying to create these filters for everything you could think of, yeah, that's tedious. and it may never be very effective in the end with, you know, tens of thousands of hours put into it. So having these machines to be able to, if we can show them what the ideal sound is and they can listen to a variety of things and then give it back to us without all the noise removed is exactly what we need. So, and if they can then take this one step further and make it a true learning system, where it can hear new environments and then add to that body of information. And good golly, if they could incorporate that all into some sort of cloud service where it could all be collected and better analyzed on a large scale, then I think that would just make it an even more solid product. But I talk to so many people who are either older or have damaged their hearing and wear hearing aids sometimes or full time, and they're not perfect products by any means.
But they're so much better than they used to be.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. And I work in some, or I occasionally work around some very noisy environments too, and I see the challenges of where you've just adjusted your hearing aid to deal with this loud environment, then you walked out of that situation and it has to be readjusted again and back and forth. Or the time you forget to do it and you shock yourself pretty good.
I hate that feeling.
Anyway, good work by the folks over at Ohio State University. A great article over on the IEEE org website. And all about more deep learning. Coolness.
More deep learning. Samsung's flagship UHD Blu-ray player, the M9500, which is shockingly similar to the UDP or the UBD-K8500 design, except adds a front display, Bluetooth audio output, 4K apps.
It's really similar.
That's basically one of the first things we're probably going to hear about at CES.
Most definitely. It's really no different. The M9500 has been announced.
Right.
They're going to have it on display working at CES. And it adds that front display, as well as the cool thing being the Bluetooth audio output, I think. One, it'd be a way for you to add this device into a current home theater. Has the dual HDMI outputs on this flagship player, so you can do it one audio only to an older receiver. The other one directly to a 4K UHD display. But the Bluetooth part, that allows you then to add, say, Bluetooth headphone support built right in. And I want to say it's also two-way. I'll have to double-check that as well. So you could actually stream audio back and forth if you wanted to make it easier. That would make sense, I would think. But well, either way, it's a simple upgrade for a home theater. And I'd be curious to see what the pricing is compared to the current one.
There's a reason that the engineers that put together the CD audio spec did 44.1 kilohertz 16-bit sampling frequencies for CDs, because technically, from a mathematical standpoint, that's all you need to get all the audio range that people can hear. And you can argue about whether or not, you know, harmonics and stuff that are beyond the range of, you know, a normal 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz hearing range, right? You know, and like I said, if you want to buy, a friend of mine who has probably heard every headphone on the planet, or probably has heard more of every headphone on the planet, certainly anybody else I know, he's like, look, I can't hear a difference between, you know, the whatever crazy K, you know,
sample rate they're
sample
using
rate, yeah, that I'm using from HD tracks. But I know that more of the music that came from the mix is there from the original tape, and I'll pay to have that 192 kilohertz 24-bit version. You know, if I'm going to buy the album, I'm going to buy it at the highest possible sort of resolution
it's
I can get.
Pretty much how I feel about Blu-ray audio too. I mean, it's just if I can find the track I want, it's arguably the highest bitrate source I can find, and if it was authored properly, it should provide me the best source material for what I'm doing.
Yeah.
That's the other thing, too. CDs, it's like, man, if you can hear the difference between the CD and the ultra or the HD version of a song, you've got pretty good, one, hearing, and two, audio gear, most likely. So if you hear a difference at all, you almost can't test yourself unless you can randomize it somehow. You almost need somebody to A-B it for you. So
you need sort of, you know, yeah, I was going to say, you know, you need legit Blu-ray that's blind. Well, the reason I bring this up is one of the things that's happening at CES this year is the Digital Entertainment Group, you know, which is, you know, they support 4K Ultra HD, you know, 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray disc, digital HD, ultraviolet, digital copy, you know, 3D, DVD, HDTV. They focus on informing consumers of the many benefits associated with new home entertainment technologies and products, which is basically to say they're like CEA, but with a very, very narrower focus. They are doing an event for high-res audio. And what's interesting about this one, not to take anything away from Samsung's decision, that we have a thing, and it's 32-bit, and it's going to be awesome. But Sony Music, Universal, and Warner Music Group, which are three rather large labels, are then working together with, like, Astell & Curran, AudioQuest, you know, DTS, ELAC, MQA, Onkyo, you know, Samsung, Sony, a bunch of other crews to do a high-res audio update, which is what they're calling it. So I'm kind of curious. Right? I've never seen the labels actually really get behind one of these. And that's one of the issues a lot of people have is that, you know, somebody's got the source, and if they don't, you know, give you access to the source to create an actual high-resolution version of the file. So I'll be really curious what this means. I'll be really curious to see what the response is. You know,
it would be nice to see some heavyweight sound experts say, like, you know, there is some benefit to this if you have gear that is optimized for reproducing, you know. It goes well beyond maybe what an average setup would be. But like you said, too, getting beyond being able to reproduce CD quality audio effectively. I mean, if you get to that point, it's going to be great. Let alone, like, this applies to movies as well that use their various audio codecs and standards. But
I don't know
to a level and then to be able to perceive beyond that something of higher quality.
Right.
I think most folks are just struggling to get to that first step.
Yeah.
They're not even hearing CD fully, let alone adding better quality formats to gear that might not be able to handle it.
I suspect blind A-B testing, you know, where there's like a, you know, audio transparent sheet between the equipment or the source and
things I predict that will not be at this upcoming Audio Fest.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, there's, you know, I am all about people enjoying the process of collecting audio gear and stuff. I will be curious to see what the announcement is, what the distribution is, you know, do they have like, you know, is there going to be like, do we now have another competitor to Tidal and Spotify and Apple Music and Play and Amazon? Or I'm curious, right? I'm going to try to be there on Thursday, January 5th when that goes down. But
my hope too is that they'll have some of the audio recording experts there too to talk a little bit about how this would benefit them in terms of the work they do on the high end, and then if they can transition more of that information into consumers' ears.
Well, I mean, that was MQA,
yeah,
like last year. They're like, we have a way of encoding the music so that you get more of the audio that was on the board, and
a lot of marketing foo.
There's a lot of marketing foo.
It's hard
there.
To wade through that sometimes.
Oh my!
You want to believe? I really do.
Yes, but blind A/B testing.
That convinces me a lot better than
than
a press release.
There you have it, people. Your question from Chris, who wrote ask@avxl.com. Hi, guys. Question four, during or after CES, is 2017 the year to buy a Dolby Atmos receiver? Or does it feel like things are still evolving? To date, it still feels like version 1.0 or 1.5, with version 2.0 being where the updates and evolution start to settle down. How about 4K in terms of receivers? Are things starting to settle down there? Looking forward to your coverage. Thanks, Chris from Calgary.
I think it's a great time to buy a Dolby Atmos receiver.
Yeah. The biggest issue with Dolby Atmos right now is that there's just not a lot of titles.
True.
That's the biggest challenge for Dolby Atmos.
I would like to see more preamp products out there that you could just add whatever damn amp you want and just to have all the channels in the world for speaker expansion down the road and let you deal with the amplification however you want. That's probably not for everyone. A lot of people are very comfortable just getting a single box that has enough amplification to handle 5 or 7 so odd speakers. And that's going to be an easy way to go. The only thing I would say for new AVRs is just making sure that the 4K support is there for you. So you don't have to think about that. HDCP22, HDMI 2.0A. Hopefully those are well settled in this receiver and that when you start plugging these products in a year from now, you're not going to have a problem or it's been updated to fix that problem before you have to encounter it. So that's really my only... I don't see Atmos changing drastically.
No.
It's just the only thing I see on the home side is, man, I'd like to be able to maybe start with 5 channels and maybe double that down the road or, you know, or triple it.
Well, that's the biggest thing.
I go crazy
in terms of affordable receivers. It's enormously difficult to find an affordable receiver that does 4 channels.
I'd almost like to have it. I'm getting to that point where I just want the amplification separate so I can just give me the inputs and outputs on one box and then let me do amplification on another box. And actually, I just, for whatever reason, I want like a preamp like that and then I want to use a bunch of those like T-class amplifiers. Use like a dozen of them.
Upgrade the power supplies.
Give me some of the pies.
There's nothing wrong with a Lehigh or Leap or whatever they're calling it this
whatever
month,
it is, yeah.
Except that, you know, it could... Don't use the power supply that came in the box.
Exactly. Yeah.
I just bought an ATI 5-channel amp for used off of Craigslist because I love Craigslist. I like buying, you know, something that would cost me $2,500 new for
I have gotten rid of everything from VCRs to... game consoles to you name it, man. Craigslist is awesome for that kind of thing.
You know, I'm playing around with some mods for the
T-class amps.
Yeah, the T-class amps. They recently, though, whatever company in China that makes those and then they're sold under a bunch of different brand names, apparently they did some major
consolidation
updates to PCB. So a lot of the first few years of those $25 power amplifier mods don't really apply to the next generation.
But. I mean, my very limited understanding of how things are done in China, I would say one, they initially get a hold of a design, effectively copying something, then they learn how to make it really well, and then they start pushing the design.
Yeah.
And I think they're at that stage 3 right now.
Yeah,
these new T-class amps. Now I'm curious. I suddenly want to see the new board designs and stuff. So,
yeah. So the Pi was the original one. They still sell them on Parts Express and Amazon.com. It's basically it claims to be a 20 watt amplifier for $25. It's more like 3.5 watts. and
still,
that might be being generous. But Class T amplifiers are essentially a version of Class D or switching amplifier. This started out as a company called TriPath, which I'm pretty sure eventually got bought by Texas Instruments. But there's a lot of those out there. But if you have a set of garage sale speakers and you need an amplifier to get them running, the Leppy or Lepi 2020 or 2024, they sell for like $25 on Amazon or Parts Express. Those are pretty. I'm actually shocked at how good they are for the money. They also they don't consume a lot of power, so they're great if you want to build a boombox or a suitcase speaker system.
I love it for that. You can run it on just a few watts.
Just enough
baby.
Wattage to make you happy. Chris. So hopefully that helps. Mark, a.k.a. at Staggered6, tweets, "You two are thick as thieves. I like it. If I could buy you both a beer, I would. Pound Texilla." thank you, Mark.
Oh.
And you know, Mark, there's always patreon.com/AVXL. And if y'all get us to $1,000 a month, we'll start doing a video once a month along with the podcast audio. It's not going to be fancy 3-camera studio switch like we used to do on HD Nation, but it will be our faces, facial reactions, and gestures.
Yes.
There's a lot of gestures you don't get on the podcast.
I will put pants on.
Thank God. Help me, people. Patreon.com/AVXL.
Hey, also, we got that meetup for the Techzilla crew.
Yeah.
Techzilla. Did I say Techzilla?
Yeah.
No.
You did say Techzilla.
I did.
God. I work a tech thing now.
I pictured the word. I was surfing that site. Actually, somebody used that the HD Nation logo on their Twitter account.
Yes.
I thought that was kind of cute. Anyway, random.
Oh, wow.
Costco Vision Center calling right now. Oh, I've got new glasses. As I ignore these phone calls coming in right now, I just say, I talked last week about getting your vision checked, and my new prescription glasses apparently are done. And God, I can't wait to put them on. I get all the pixels now, baby.
It's so much easier to calibrate television when you see something other than a shiny blur.
Super minor tweak to my vision, but it did make a difference in the time of acquisition to targeting. I'll say it that way.
If you're at CES 2017, the meetup with Patrick Shannon and Robert, or me and Robert and Shannon, will be at Atomic Liquor and Cocktails.
That's right.
Atomic Liquors, 917 Fremont Street, Las Vegas, Nevada, 89101. The oldest freestanding bar in Las Vegas.
Really?
Really.
Oh, I got to stand there.
I think all the other – it's a fantastic – it's probably my second favorite place to hide in Las Vegas after the Double Down Saloon, which is a little louder.
Yeah.
The Atomic Lounge.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of where I like to hole up.
We'll be from PJ's with the buckets of food. or yeah. JP's. What is that place?
There's only like 30 of them in Vegas. I keep wanting to say PJ's. It's not PJ's. Oh, this is killing me.
In any case, Atomic Liquor's Friday night, 7 p.m. till I'll probably be there till at least midnight, knowing me.
Oh, it is PJ's.
It is PJ's.
PJ's Pub.
That's the one.
I'm pretty sure it's PJ's.
Robert loves that place.
Man, they serve buckets of food. And it's dark. And in the summertime, there is not a better place to walk into because it's so hot outside. And you always walk through this pitch black glass door. It's like, what the hell am I about to walk into? Oh, buckets of delicious food, pool tables, and very cold beverages. And I'm like, this is heaven. Thank you.
Yeah, we got a low bar for heaven, but it's a nice heaven.
I need a picture here. Let me see if
in
I can get
case.
A picture. I don't know if it's PJ's Pub. It's some, and now all the locals in Vegas are just screaming at me right now.
As well they should. Well, any case, Mark, feel free to support us on patreon.com/AVXL, and thank you for your kind tweet. While you're looking up the picture of PJ's Pub, I'm gonna read up Evan's tweet.
I need a bucket of burgers.
But it makes me a bucket of burgers and a bucket of fries. And they serve coffee, which is great. So
there.
You can have, like, you know, beer.
I don't know where the food
coffee.
Comes from there. I see no sign of a kitchen.
Don't,
yeah, exactly.
Just,
I ain't going back there to look either. I just somehow magic comes out of there.
Accept the nice bucket and move on with life. Evan tweets at AVXL, is this asking for trouble? A lot of hard drives, an Xbox, TiVo, Western Digital next to my shoe, VTF2. And Evan attached a picture of a stack of gear a few inches to the right of a lovely shoe subwoofer. Short answer, no.
I took a look at that stack, though, and I would immediately put that amp on top of all that crap.
Yeah.
He had all the hottest thing at the bottom with that needs all the ventilation in the world with two devices relatively sealed with vents out the back on top of that. And I was like,
it's funny. And it's that was literally both of us were having the same thought. Like you need to pull the hard drive, like rip the hard drive out of your Xbox, take the subwoofer out of the bottom of the shoe, attach the hard drive to the subwoofer magnet.
What are you trying to do?
Well, if he wants to damage the hard drive.
Oh.
Right? Like, literally, you basically, like, and even then.
Oh. He's, like, worried about the hard drives in those devices?
Yeah.
Next to a sub?
No. He does not. Yes, he is worried about that. No, he does not have to worry about that. I mean, literally, if he wanted to damage a hard drive, I would, like, pull the subwoofer out of the box and, like, attach the hard drive to the magnet on the back of the subwoofer.
The drive has its own mechanisms for dealing with vibration and errors and things like that.
I think
that were an issue, but you're also implying somehow that sound's going to make it all the way into where the drive is and affect it enough.
I was assuming he was worried about magnetism rather than vibration.
Ah, yeah.
You know, I mean...
I disassembled a hard drive the other day just for the old notebook drive that died on me. So I'm like, oh, what the hell? I got these. I got my my screwdriver set from the good folks over at iFixit, and I'm like, took it all apart. And I was really impressed on the notebook side of things, how efficient it is in terms of the layout. And the little things they do to minimize shock every point within that design was really neat. And granted, that's a notebook drive designed to be bumped around a little bit more, but – Also, if you ever take one of those drives apart, wash your hands if you play with those platters. There's stuff on those. That's don't lick
stuff.
It. Don't lick the shiny surface.
Do not lick the inside of a hard drive.
No, don't.
But yeah, both of us actually had kind of saw the same thing. Is the giant heat generating amplifier is sitting under your TiVo and your Xbox, and most importantly, that really expensive Nighthawk router. And heat is really bad for routers, as far as I can tell, and it's not very good for the TiVo, and it's not very good for the Xbox.
Those are usually vented out the back with right. a fan. So as long as it's relatively dust free right. and it's got ventilation to be able to push that air through, those are fine. But generally on your amplifiers, they don't have active cooling on them. They're made to right. radiate, and you just don't want to cover the top.
Yeah.
Chances are nothing's going to happen to any of that unless you're driving it like a madman in a 150 degree room or something. But it's just a simple change. Put the hot thing on top. Let everything else vent out the back. And
let physics work for you, Evan, not against you.
Oh, thermodynamics. I love you so.
Oh, my goodness.
We're still recovering from. Seriously.
Oh, man. Hey, if you've never heard of SHU before, shuresearch.com.
HSU.
And they make some of the finest subwoofers for the money out there. And they used to have the SDF series, which is now the bottom. That was their entry level, which is now their VTF-1 Mark III subwoofer, which costs about $400, which is a big step up from like a monoprice subwoofer.
I was gonna say, either I'm going the monoprice route for $100, right. or I'm looking at something like SHU.
Yeah.
If I'm gonna go up above that at all, that's exactly where I'll be.
This would be a good conversation to have with Brent Butterworth, because as far as I can tell. Brent Butterworth has tested more subwoofers than any other human being alive.
I think Brent would tell you that the monoprice is the way to go.
Yeah, he did. He picked it. He said that, and then the Andrew Jones designed Pioneer subwoofer.
The thing is, too, at that price, at $100 price point, I'd get two of them. Because if your amp supports it, cancel those nulls out. Even better.
That's a good thing. Yeah, that SHU, right? Their entry-level SHU, if you close one port on that, because they give you multiple ports so you can tune it for either maximum volume or maximum depth. You get 22 hertz out of it, like an honest 22 hertz, which is way lower than you need. Well, I was thinking about this.
That's a nice number.
Yeah, it's a very nice number. But when you realize it, like people are like, 20 hertz, 20,000 hertz. I'm like, you probably can't hear anything near 20,000 hertz.
Oh, I can't.
And, you may be able to hear 20 hertz.
That along the way.
Most music doesn't go down that low. Like, okay, so...
Oh, let alone compressed audio, like MP3.
Yeah, I mean, Tchaikovsky, some audio stuff, but when you're talking about, like,
any streaming source, pretty
the
much.
The lowest string on a bass guitar is 41 hertz. Like, a five-string bass might be down around 31 hertz. But the reason you see so many speakers going down to about 40 hertz before they kind of quit and decide not to add either, a larger woofer or to redesign the cabinet is because most, 40 hertz is where most of the music is, like 40 hertz to 10,000.
Is there any standard that says what the max drop-off can be before you can really call it within that range?
Well, the reason why a lot of places like, speakers go from, our speaker goes from 20 hertz to,
Yeah, there's some sound coming out of it, but is it... It's not like it is in the mid range.
The reason they usually would put like 3 dB, 5 dB, like somewhere between 3 and 5 dB is where it starts becoming an audible drop, right? Those KEF egg speakers, like I think they say they stop at around 80 hertz. I can still hear it quite well at 50 hertz, but it's outside of what KEF.
Right.
KEF is honorable enough to say, like, this is based on our standards. This is where it drops below what we think is an honest return.
Our marketing foo is
a few
factors less.
But there's a lot of places where it's like, it goes from 30 hertz to 20,000 hertz. And it's like, well, it's negative 15 dB at 30 hertz, which is... a big drop if the vast majority of the audible frequency range is within 3 dB of a flat line. And then that's a good question. That's like one of the things I love about Audioholics is because they're constantly hammering on companies that they don't really want to talk about. They don't want to give you a lot of sort of verifiable measurements of performance.
Those guys are good at cutting through the marketing.
Yeah.
And they've seen enough. And I like their historics on things where, hey, they've seen a few generations of a particular product now, and they are really good at honing in exactly what's been done for the latest version, whether or not it's an improvement, a worthwhile improvement or not.
Yeah.
That those kind of little insights, I can't get enough of.
No.
Truly.
Oh, my goodness. Sorry, now I'm like deep in the specs of something, and I'm going to stop before I completely lose my mind. Josh from New Jersey emailed ask@avxl.com. Hey, Robert and Patrick, I currently own a Samsung 55 LED 8 series from a year or two ago. I purchased an AXA Pico projector for our room, and while the picture quality is not the greatest, I became hooked on viewing content on an 85 to 120-inch screen. Even my friend's 65-inch LG OLED was meh to me. Beautiful picture, but way too small. I am currently looking at an Epson Home Cinema 2040 as my first projector in my current budget. Will I be able to achieve a similar picture quality as my Samsung at 85 to 95 inches in a blacked out room with dark gray walls and ceiling? How complicated is calibrating a projector compared to my TV? Can I still set grayscale with my colorimeter? Thanks, Josh from New Jersey. I feel comfortable, and you can feel free to poke holes in this. I feel comfortable in saying that you will have similar picture quality. I think 1080p blown up at 90 or 100 inches looks fantastic.
Totally. What was the size screen he was looking at shooting to?
I want
to
say 85. No.
85 to 95?
Yeah.
That's a good size for just about any projector, especially if you're dealing with any kind of ambient lighting in the room. It's not as big as getting over 100 inches.
Uh-huh.
Generally, the bigger the screens, you need more light to light that up effectively. And the smaller screen, relatively, get into that 80 to 100 inch size, those are generally brighter with the same mm-hmm. projector. So I think you're going to have a fantastic image, especially in a light, if you can truly black out the room. That projector should be overkill. Should be more than enough projector for that screen setup. Ideally in this setup too for projectors, if you can put the lens setup somewhere in the middle, don't crank it all the way to like fully zoomed or fully wide open. That helps minimize things like image distortions and other aspects. Although if you can leave the lens wide open, you'll get the most light out of it, but that generally would require you to then put it closer to the screen. And it all depends on your setup. So just going there, but for what he's describing, it sounds like a great setup. And with that black border around a projection screen, when you get this dialed in, it's going to blow away any similar TV. And the size wise is really what gets impressive too, because you're suddenly adding 20, 30 inches to a 65 inch screen with adequate light output. I mean, you will be in no way bummed by the brightness of this picture. It's going to be plenty bright. And chances are that's probably a 3D projector too. Yeah, 3D LCD, 1080p. So if you wanted to do 3D viewing as well, that should be a great setup for that. Those glasses are generally pretty affordable, although they are like, I think they're liquid crystal shutter glasses you have to use with those projectors. But anyway, that will provide an awesome setup. You could get away with a gray screen if you want, but again, I don't think you need to, especially in a light-controlled environment. Mm-hmm. As long as light is not striking the screen, ambient light is reaching the screen, it's bad enough when you have a room with light-colored walls and then the reflected light off the screen is hitting the walls and then making it back to the screen. Those kind of scenarios can all get wacky, but it sounds like he's got a terrific setup. And as far as calibrating the projector, as long as your meter is cool, can be positioned so that it can read the projected screen surface with the projector running, you're good to go. The beauty too of projectors is that the light output doesn't change dramatically with picture size or with test pattern size or other issues you run into on dynamic style pixel displays like OLEDs and stuff, where you have to be real careful about the window size you're using and other things like that. Generally, projectors, you just run them at give me full frame images for test colors and grayscale setup. Put the meter where it's convenient, generally as close to the middle as you can within where it's going to read off the screen. And then be aware, too, of the shadow created by the colorimeter. Don't put that right where it's trying to read off the screen. Try to minimize the angle of incidence in terms of pointing that meter at the screen.
Right.
You can't point it right at the screen because its own shadow will block it. So you got to angle a little bit. And that's where then the screen material can be more that's where you have to consider that as well. If you're dealing with highly reflective screens, mm-hmm. they change characteristics off axis. So those ones that are better Lambertian diffusers, like that sweet Stuart film screen, their reference quality screens are effectively perfect diffusers, reference diffusers in terms of getting that light distributed through the room. But most screens you're dealing with aren't highly reflective. Most standard, you know, relatively neutral gain screens are going to be fine. So you don't have to worry about that angle too much. You just make sure you're reading a part of the screen that's not being influenced by something else. I've even had like situations where a reflection, the projector's hitting the meter and creating a reflection onto the screen. You just want to make sure you're avoiding anything like that. You're reading a nice clean part of what's being displayed on the screen.
Just go old school. Aim the color right over, attach it to the lens on the front of the projector.
In projector testing, you would do that because if you're trying to take...
I'm joking, by the way.
...the screen out of it. If you just want to test the performance of the projector, then yeah, you literally would turn it around and have it just eating the light right out of the projector. But the screen will affect the image quality, so you have to calibrate it off that screen. So
I was amazed. We've been running without a screen in my living room for a while. And, you know, so you mentioned Lombardian reflectance.
Diffusion.
Yeah, well, reflectance or diffusion. Yeah. But so Lombardian reflection is an ideal matte, diffusely reflecting surface that looks exactly the same from any corner of the room, right?
Off-axis viewing on a screen like that will blow away any LCD.
Yeah. And, you know, if you want to get deep into Lambert's cosine law, find somebody else because I'm not going to do it with you.
I ain't going there.
But, you know,
I'll pull out my phone.
We'd had a textured surface on that wall, which we were ignoring for the purposes of not having to deal with hanging the screen. And I was shocked at how much better the color got and how much more light was being reflected to us on the screen than it was on that particular wall.
Yeah, textured walls are great for absorbing sound or breaking up sound a little bit, but they're not necessarily the best screen surfaces. Impromptu, man, it's better than nothing.
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't even like a popcorn ceiling type. It was just, you know, the way they had finished the plaster in this room.
And then sometimes you get slightly glossy paints that do weird things when you're just trying... lots of oddity, and that's why it's nice to have a consistent screen surface to work with, and they're affordable.
If you want to learn a lot about screens for projectors in a short period of time, the Wirecutter's best projector screen for most people. Chris Hanonen wrote that up for the Wirecutter. It gets you deep into a lot of stuff really fast and without a lot of emotional trauma.
Man, he had a great setup. He had about, I think, a dozen different screens he went through, including the very best to the whatever he could find. Just what's out there that you could find today, and the results were surprising.
Oh, my goodness. Before we get to our next viewer question, I want to point out, in theory, from a scientific perspective, a 3 dB change, which is like a doubling of acoustic energy, is audible.
Okay. So when you're talking about audio changes, 3 dB should be noticeable.
Theoretically.
For average hearing?
Yeah. Well, physics says that, you know, doubling of acoustic energy is a 3 dB increase. But the reality, the perceived sound levels that you actually hear are probably more like, you know, if you test humans rather than looking at physics, then 5 dB is a noticeable change to the human ear. That's why most places, you know, a lot of more honest speaker companies or more upfront speaker companies, honest may be a poor choice of words on my part.
Established.
Well, I wouldn't even say established, but there, you know what I mean? Like there's companies that give you the blunt force trauma, like, oh, you want that spec? Here's that spec for our amplifier. You know, in a way that a lot of companies are like, no, you don't. You know, it's like the horsepower on a Rolls Royce is listed as adequate or used to be back in the day, right?
I like that.
But in the case of,
obscene.
A lot, completely unhinged. But for most, if you're looking at a speaker, they may list like 80 hertz to 45,000 hertz. Like that's actually the listing for that KEFEG. But at 80 hertz, it's down like 3 or 5 decibels. But there's still a lot of audible, you know, sound under that. That if they were more generous or simply eliminated like the dB rating, they might be able to claim that their speaker was much lower. So that's
I used to appreciate the graphs that would be included with speakers, at least in terms of like the sound measurement at 1 meter, blah blah blah, in an anechoic environment or however.
But at what frequency, Robert?
Exactly.
Is it A weighted or C weighted?
Hopefully.
Oh, if you have questions about this, email ask@avxl.com.
I have to look at my meter. Which one's for human hearing? Is it A weighting? Damn it! I'm not thinking about that right now.
I'm not going down there.
I'll go back to my reference material.
Well, you know, Yeah, I mean, the ear at higher levels, 100 dB and above, the ear's response is flatter, as shown as the C-weighted responses. A-weighted is used for most sources. So basically, A-weighting eliminates a lot of the low-frequency noise. But that's a whole other conversation.
Oh, yeah.
A-weighting follows the frequency sensitivity of the human ear at low levels. And it also predicts quite well the risk of damage to the ear for a given volume or a given, like, measurement.
Bob emailed ask@avxl.com. Hey, guys, I have a very active toddler.
I can relate, man. Who can now reach over and behind the home theater bench, an old IKEA Billy bookshelf hacked with legs, doors, and active cooling. Nice.
I have my plasma, last of the Panasonics, Mad Max reference, wall mounted and a cable raceway covering the cables to and from it. However, I need to secure the maze of tangled wires in the very cramped space below. What do you guys use? Any particular products that actually work well and are easy to manage during the seemingly always needed system maintenance? Any particular techniques you employ? Do you guys bundle all of the cables in the same type together, all power cords in a bundle, Ethernet in a bundle, HDMI in a bundle, like a set of utility conduits across the entire back of the cabinet, or just bundle all the cables for each component separately? Any favorite way of securing the bundled cables down that is easily unsecured for maintenance? Is it worthwhile breaking out the Brother P-Touch 2? I have my screen mounted at viewing height while seated on a couch, kind of low. Aside from raising the TV high on the wall, any advice on protecting the screen on my plasma from impacts while not screwing up the viewing experience? I know. Get a projector, Bob.
Bob is doomed.
Yeah. Everything I know about peanut butter and plasma screens comes from having a child or a peanut butter.
It's the
LCD
number one
screens.
Thing I see in terms of TVs getting damaged is usually a remote or something being thrown at the screen.
Which actually I would like to point out is often not a four-year-old.
Usually not.
Ironically, as you get later in the playoff season and or,
get your buddy over at the house and or somebody's got a game controller in their hand. The Wiis were the worst because if you didn't wear that strap and they only warn you like 50 different ways. But anyway.
You know, there is no patch for human.
He's dealing with a wall mount TV that has the cable cover.
This is good.
Keeping it down.
Yeah, he's got the mess of cables inside the box, right?
And then where the cabinet is, where everything is?
Yeah, I mean.
Okay, the AV gear. Okay.
Working this backwards, like, your only defense for a child and protecting the screen is getting it out of their reach until they're old enough to know better than damage the screen. I mean, if you're feeling kind of crazy, yeah, you could go out and get a sheet of, PVC, not PVC.
Oh, like plexi.
Yeah.
Protecting the screen surface, I wouldn't recommend putting anything on the screen. Yeah. I mean, unless you're looking to turn it into like an outdoor version of your TV, but you're going to ruin your image quality doing all that.
And that's the problem. Like, anything you can do that's going to prevent somebody from throwing something through the screen. I mean, look, if you're, if you're setting up a television in a honky tonk and there's some beer bottle throwing action every Friday night, then yeah. You know, throw the sheet of PVC in front of it, but that's a pretty rednecky kind of thing to do.
Just having that TV wall mounted in the first place is arguably the best thing you could have done. And then it doesn't sound like you're dealing with cable, or he's not dealing with cables that are hanging below the TV. That was the first thing you need to clean up anyway, because that's the first thing kids grab. It's unreal.
Yeah,
they just see that dangling there, and it's like, let me pull on these cables connected to thousands of dollars worth of gear.
My kid wanted to climb it. My oldest wanted to climb it, and by the time the youngest came around, we had the projector going on.
One, I made sure the wall mount could hold at least my body weight. and then you've got the cable secured all the way down there. So if it's I'm just kind of having a hard time visualizing what it is he needs to tighten up. Is it behind?
Basically, he's got his box, right, underneath his television.
Gotcha.
And it's got all of his home theater gear inside of it. And there's basically a giant rat's nest of cables behind the home theater gear.
Especially when you're dealing with all those speaker inputs.
The child can reach behind the bench. I mean, my number one piece of advice is, like, spend the money to buy the shortest possible cable you can use to connect two components. Right?
Totally.
1 foot HDMI cables, 2 foot HDMI cables are amazing for stacked gear. Number two, at your local Home Depot, Lowe's, or hardware store, there should be, I've been saying this a lot this holiday season, there should be a Velcro rack, an area where the Velcro stuff is. You know, for $5.20, $5.30, you get like 100 8-inch by half-inch reusable Velcro ties. And as much as I love zip-tying cables together, that's great for the truck. It's great for race vehicles. It's a wicked ripping pain in the ass if you have to reconfigure stuff. I try to avoid bundling power cables with HDMI cables, USB cables, or especially audio cables. You know, I try to make my Ethernet cables cross power cables at a 90-degree angle because I just used to hang out with a lot of engineers. I think that's probably overkill, but it's not a bad idea from a technical perspective. So the first thing I would do is you kind of figure out what the distance is between your devices and whether or not you can go to shorter HDMI cables. You know, I would get a bundle of those Velcro ties, and I would start, you know, making large, not tiny, loops with cables, and, you know, looping them shorter and or replacing them with shorter cables, you know, from Amazon Basics or Monoprice. It can be really, really simple. You know, from an ease of use standpoint, it's so nice to have the power cable, the Ethernet cable, the HDMI cable, any other cables bundled into one bundle, but I don't like running my power cable next to my other signals. You know, I think that may be overkill, but...
Also, too, if you haven't already, if you're using multiple inputs on the TV and you don't have to, if you can regulate everything to the being inputted through the AVR... Mm-hmm. Clean that up, reduce it even further, what's going out there, because then you get rid of a bunch of cables that are connecting directly to the AVR as well.
The Brother Labeler, the P-Touch, labelers are amazing.
Masking tape and a Sharpie,
yeah.
If nothing else. But sure, if you've ever gone through all of your speaker wires once...
go to Costco, spend
like
the 20
bucks
on
the house.
On
there's
a bundle
coming
labeler.
Out of the wall of, God, how many... 10, 12 wires coming out of the wall. And it's like, I'm not going to go through that more than once to figure out which one goes to where. So.
You don't want to have to do that twice. And print out two labels, one for each end of it, you know. Not that you're, you know, depending on how you're setting it up, it may make a difference. But it's nice to have the labels, you know, left front, center front, right front, you know. You know, HDMI 1, HDMI 2, HDMI 3, or HDMI 1 DVD player, HDMI 2 Xbox, HDMI 3... You know,
this also doesn't probably sound like Bob's issue, but I've also seen so many times where somebody just connects everything on the back of a device, like every stupid analog and digital connection. They just don't know. And so take a look at that, too. If they don't need the component video cable with the left-right audio cable in addition to the HDMI cable and everything, that's where you can help a lot, too. So getting it to the basics and then making those cable runs as tight as possible. And then as far as in the cabinet goes, that's where it can get challenging, too, because you're dealing with like a bundle of speaker wire coming in. And then once it's hooked up, you know, you got to carefully push everything back and make sure it all fits right. But
having cable races can be nice because you can just hide stuff underneath them.
Also, too, if it's inside of the cabinet, that's the issue. See if you can then route more of those wraps of the extra cable outside and maybe hang it on the back with Velcro or a zip tie or something screwed or whatever into the back of the cabinet. So that way it won't be inside the cabinet, maybe where it's easier to access. Because ideally this cabinet would be closed.
I think that's part of the problem is that the young Sprog can now reach over the back.
It's not like that's going to stop a
well, anytime,
anyway.
Or just, you know, build a little wooden closure to cover the back of that so that young Sprog cannot reach the cables.
I would booby trap things. I mean... A mild electrical shock,
wonders.
In the right place, unexpectedly.
You've never met my kids.
Child rearing may not be legal. I'm not sure. I have to consult with my attorney.
Yeah, well, you know, they do know those things that there's...
I'm just thinking, can I do something with like a sheet of foil back there with a couple little clips on there and maybe a 9-volt battery? I don't know. I think something more spark probably than a 9-volt is going to give me. But,
oh, man.
Anyway... That's not helpful.
You know, cats chewing on electrical cords can be a real nightmare.
Cats? What is it with cats and freaking earbuds? I can't pick up a set of earbuds without the cat just attacking me. Anyway.
I don't know what that's about. Bo Kelly tweets multiple times. There's a multi-part tweet. A multi-part tweet from Bo Kelly. It says, I need your advice on a DAC amp for my PC. I'm currently using a pair of ATH M50X headphones, but plan to upgrade to do something better in the near future. I've been looking at the Shit Stack, Audio Engine D1, and Mayflower Desktop Objective 2 with ODAC Rev B, and was wondering what your thoughts are. Which would you choose, or is there something else I should be looking at? Thanks in advance, Bo. So, digital analog converter, that's the thing that turns the zeros and ones that your music is stored on in the computer into an analog signal. And the amplifiers, once you start getting into, like, I'm a serious audiophile, you get, like, a dedicated headphone amp. Or more often than not these days, not spending all the money, the DAC and the amp are in the same enclosure.
What output are you using on a computer, generally, to do this?
USB. Optical?
Oh, USB. Oh, there you go. Okay.
It's in it. Well, there's still. It's funny because
that makes total sense. Jeez.
I've been doing USB for a really long time, and I got a device for testing. That we were talking about a couple weeks ago, Elac's Discovery Music Server, and I was talking to one of the guys at Elac, and he's like, "Oh, most people aren't really using the onboard DAC; they're using the optical output on that." And it was a funny moment because I've been so computer-centric in my audio consumption for so long. It was like, I haven't run a preamp in forever, right? Because I go directly from a digital source to the power amplifier to the speakers. Because I started, around the time I started getting serious about music was the point where people were going from active preamps to passive preamps. And then my illogical extension of that was to eliminating the preamp entirely.
Now that's all I want.
Yeah, well, so there's a coaxial output on that Elac Discovery Music Server, and there are lots and lots of digital analog converters that'll use a coaxial input before your preamp. But if you're not familiar with like the ODAC and the O2, is essentially a mostly anonymous human being known as NWAV guy or Northwest Audio and Video guy. Was very, very active online in the forums, as they say, and came up with basically got everybody together and was trying to come up with an ideal sort of and then created an open source design for a headphone amplifier. And then turned around and did the ODAC, which was the same thing. So Mayflower makes these, I know the guys at JDS Labs, a couple of the guys that work at JDS Labs. They make the elements, they make the objective and ODAC there. They do I've built so many of these, I should be able to remember the CMOI headphone amplifier, the Altoids tin headphone amplifier.
Ah, that I remember.
I'm a big fan of JDS Labs elements. In part because, it's got a great big knob on it. And,
okay.
In terms of specs, you shouldn't be able to hear any difference. You could easily also spend, $6,000, for a headphone amplifier. Cavalli Audio sells like $6,000 headphone amplifiers. I'm not buying one anytime soon because I'm just not in that category of, $6,000 to me is a car. But... in any case, Shit's making really, really good stuff. Mayflower, like JDS Labs, if you're looking at the ODAC or the Objective 2, you're essentially looking at a spec design, an open source design. Everything's built to that spec. So either one of those should be great. I'm a huge fan of the Elements, which is a very powerful amplifier, more power than you really, really need for the vast majority of headphones from JDS Labs. If you want to save money, they do B-stock sales if there's light imperfections on it. The idea there is that you've got no noise, an incredibly high signal to noise ratio, an excellent dynamic range, fundamentally undetectable to the human ear, for THD plus N or total harmonic.
Sounds like a great way to manipulate a digital signal,
Or
a digital converted signal.
Yeah. So there's like greater than 60 dB separation on the channel. So there's no crosstalk. The channels, should be balanced. I got to be honest with you. If you're stepping up into headphones the first time, I'd start with something simple. You're the objective to do an ODAC, I think it's a fantastic place to start. You can also buy
everything
both
listed
of those in one
awesome
box.
Stuff.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of the Audio Engine D1. I love a lot of Audio Engine's projects. I think for the money, I would go with an Audio Quest Dragonfly. For $100, Audio Quest Dragonfly, the black, is a fantastic deal. You know, Shit just did a redesign of their entry level product, and they just did a redesign of the Fulla. So the original Fulla was being sold for like $59 on Amazon, which is another fantastic deal. The Fulla 2 sells for $99 and it has a volume knob. I love volume knobs on my audio gear. Because it's so much easier to turn a knob than it is to grab my mouse, get to the thing, you know, open up the menu on the computer.
I keep having flashbacks to that Hisense R&D center I was at where they showed some prototype TVs, and one of them was just a simple old school looking design of a modern LCD that had a nice big knob on it for a multifunction.
Oh.
But just a nice turn to it and a good feel.
The last of the last generation Shit Fulla USB dongle / DAC amps are gone. They sold them out on Amazon. But I got to be honest with you. Like, yeah, you can spend, you can buy the Magna 2 and the Modi 2 from Shit. I would say I would want to start with like a Shit Fulla 2, an Audio Quest Dragonfly. Start with, you know, a simple $100 DAC amp combo. Unless your next generation headphones are some seriously power consuming planar magnetics, you're going to have more than enough power to drive any headphone. You're going to have a cleaner signal than you've ever heard. You're going to have an excellent DAC. And I'd start with that and then spend more money when you can actually hear a difference. When you go to a HeadFi Can Jam, or you go to your local audio gear store and you plug in your headphones, you go, "Oh, the difference is magnifique. I must have this." Then go start spending more money on that. But
that's good rational advice, man.
Well, it's just you can start spending so much money so fast.
Yeah. But, I mean, you provided a couple great options. And then, look, if you want to go put the pedal to the floor and you have something in mind that is of excellent quality anyway, sure, you know, go that route. But I think you just made some great alternate suggestions that are worth considering for sure.
Well, you know, there's some pretty cool stuff. I mean, like JDS Labs just launched a new DAC and headphone amplifier separates. Again, they've got the Objective 2 and the OL DAC. Man, that Dragonfly series for $100 for the black is pretty fantastic.
Do you think mobile phone makers are going to eventually push high-end DA converters into their phones?
LG's done it.
Okay.
You know,
that's something else I was always kind of wondering. It's like, you know, since you carry that damn thing around with you every time, how about somebody differentiate their mobile product with just epic audio or just something that's like, man, although that takes away from the folks making these great products too. But
yeah, I mean,
but there will always be those great products.
Yeah, LG V20 is the one where they did the high-end DAC inside of it.
I'm not as up on my mobile side as I should be.
Yeah, you know, it's the truth is like especially on the iPhones, it's shocking how good the onboard DAC is. Cue angry letters from audiophiles who think I obviously don't have a clue, which may be true. But you know, the audio output from a headphone from an iPhone is actually a pretty good starting point. Your computer varies a lot depending on the motherboard manufacturer and whether or not they actually cared about audio whatsoever. But I'll stop going down that particular rat hole before I completely lose my mind.
I love my mobile. Yep. And we have an update from a viewer named Tyler who emailed ask@avxl.com. Yes, I just wanted to update you guys. On the hangout you had on Thursday, you can use any BD player that can read a BDXL disc to play a 4K UHD disc. The limitations are in software, and it appears to have been solved from a few directions. You may even try it in pretty old drives, some as old as 2011, are supposed to work. And he provided a link to the Blu-ray.com forums with a thread on this very subject, and I will be glad to include that in the show notes. Thank you, Tyler. I do appreciate it.
Woohoo!
I do!
We do.
And I made Patrick Norton laugh this morning, or today, at some point. We have a We occasionally get questions about our intro, specifically the canned part where there's something at the end that Patrick asks me. And this goes back to July. I got to say the earliest asking of a related question came from Yardy Tycoon, a.k.a. Papa Bear. He asked, what is it you say at the start of your AVXL podcast? USB or you gonna speak? Been bugging me to ask. And then I think yesterday or the day before, Brian McPherson at BMAC said, hey, Patrick Norton, what's the last word you say on the canned intro to the AVXL podcast? USB? Can't quite make it out. Happy New Year.
I believe the
only thing I'm going to say is it's not USB. And what cracked me up was that I don't think Patrick could actually listen to it all the way through, in a sense.
A long time.
At least a while, yeah. And so is it clever? Oh, I'm not going to say it's clever. Sure, I'm clever. It's not that. It was just like a reaction to a... It's very deep, actually. It's a hell of an intro. And we cherish it mightily.
We do.
I think.
Great love and affection.
Yeah.
But anyway, we're not going to tell you what it says.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that was the secret.
Just listen to it over and over again.
I think so. I think if you put this into Audacity, carefully modulate the speed of playback, optimize, boost the volume. Nah, don't boost the volume. You blow your eardrums out.
Yeah, we don't want you to blow your eardrums out.
No, we want you to come back time and again.
Please.
As we think about the upcoming week or two, we'll be in Vegas for CES.
Oh, yeah.
Ponder our pain.
Oh, it's going to be awesome.
It is.
Oh, man. So, yeah, CES next week. If you're curious, if you've got questions, we're not going to record a podcast at CES. I'll bring my podcasting gear in case Robert loses his mind and we decide to find a dark corner.
Yeah, we'll just throw on Periscope and just do something live right on a phone.
That'd be pretty hysterical. But if you've got questions about what's being announced, I mean, you know, Hisense, TLC, Samsung, LG are all going to be coming out with new designs. 1080p is going to die. It's, you know, 3D was effectively taken out back like old Yeller and shot.
Yeah.
1080p is going to be taken out back by old Yeller and shot this year.
There will always be 1080p for smaller TVs.
Sure.
But like there are still 720p
yeah.
smaller screens.
But if you're talking like, you know, 50 inches or above, it's going to get real hard. And that's not a problem.
What did we say? I think the prediction was a few years back by 2018, all TVs 55 inches and above, effectively 4K. And that is all but true at this point.
So. Yeah. And if you do get a 4K television sometime soon, you start streaming a lot of 4K video, remember that, you know, it's 7 gigabytes an hour for 4K Netflix rather than 3 gigabytes an hour for 1080p Netflix. And I bring that up because it looks like I'm going to blow through the 1 terabyte cap. I think my Netflix was left running. I think Netflix was playing like a 4-year series on autoplay.
Oh.
Well, that's 72 gigs a day or roughly.
Mine asks me every 4 episodes, are you still watching?
I don't know.
How many times have I clicked, are you still watching? Yes. Yes, I am.
Well, you know, yeah. Hopefully, you know, maybe, I don't know what happened. Something was doing something horrible in the background.
I have one of those Amplify HD routers at home, wireless routers, mm-hmm. And that gives me, I have set on the display the total bandwidth for that month of billing.
Yeah.
And it's always a nice glance over. It's like, really? 600 gigs?
I typically do 600 gigs in a month.
We have a few people in our house with lots of mobile devices. And I'm going to admit, I'm probably the one using most of the damn bandwidth. I am just pulling huge files constantly.
Pulling
and pushing.
You heard it here first, people.
Pulling!
ask@AVXL is the email address. Please use it or tweet at Robert Herron or at Patrick Norton if you got questions about stuff you hear about at CES. We'll do our best to cover it for you. Our search for a quest for a UHD Blu-ray drive for PCs may have kind of been concluded since we now know the software is coming and the existing drives will work.
We're at the chicken and the egg state now where
we
probably have drives that work.
Probably.
I could at least just stick a disc in the drive and see if it doesn't just fully reject it. But then what? Yay, I've got a disc in a drive.
I could have sworn
with no way to play it. for the love of beautiful home theater.
I thought doesn't Power DVD 16 have it?
The new version does. It's just their release is next year.
Oh, I thought they already released it.
Early first quarter of 2017.
Are you sure it isn't a Power DVD 16?
They have now, 4K man. Support, but 4K ultra high def Blu-ray playback was just added in that press release we were yapping about, I think, a
4K
week ago.
/ Blu-ray playback on TV and PC. Now 75% off.
Yeah. Blu-ray, no problem. DVD, no problem. Ultra high def Blu-ray on a PC, outputting to your TV, does not yet exist.
All right.
But it's coming.
It's on its way.
No longer a myth. apparently, it's actually happening.
Oh man,
I just want to get to Vegas and look at these new TVs. My eyeballs are going to explode. I really just got to get there.
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, avxl.com is the website to find us. Search for AVXL on iTunes, your favorite podcatcher. Get the video. Or the audio. If we get to $1,000 on patreon.com/AVXL, we'll start doing a video version of one of the episodes a month. And hey, thank you to all our patrons. Thanks you to everybody who's listening. If you got a minute, please share the show with a friend you think might be interested. And please send us your questions, because you tell us which direction to move in. And we will dance to your tune, people. But you got to play it. With that, I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Robert Aaron.
We'll see you next week on AVXL.